and welcome to We Are History, the laughable attempt at a podcast with me, John O'Farrell.
And me, Angela Barnes.
This week, Angela's going to be leading on a subject very close to her heart. It's because she's a lady. She's obsessed with marriage.
I am. That's right, John. Since I was a little girl.
It's going to be the greatest day in your life, Angela. You're a princess for a day.
Oh, all eyes on me. It's all I've ever dreamed of, John, is to be somebody's wife.
I tell you what, though, Angela. I tell you what, that's true. I tell you, take what you can get at your age, Angela.
Yeah, cheers.
I tell you what, you start off by sinking into his arms and you end up with your arms in his sink. That's what
they say. But
yeah, right.
Oh, dear. No, well, there we are. Now we've lost half the listeners. We can press on.
So, Angela is getting married this year, is that right? Yeah, later this year.
Well, all being well with all the COVID caveats that there are. I sort of stumbled across this as a topic because, yes, I am getting married this year and I am having a humanist wedding.
Oh, here we go.
I'm ignoring that. The celebrant at our wedding is the lovely Susan Ray, newsreader of Radio 4 fame.
Oh, that's a very good continuity.
So it will be very well spoken. Well, she will be. We won't. No. I wanted a humanist wedding for a number of reasons, but a humanist wedding still isn't legally recognised in England and Wales. It is in Scotland and Northern Ireland and the Channel Islands.
That's weird, isn't it?
But not in England and Wales. And there's lots of the Humanists UK are doing lots of campaigning to try and get it recognised. And it is very outdated. What frustrates me about it, because I tweeted about this the other day, and of course you get all the people on Twitter, well, all you have to do is have a separate legal ceremony. And I'm like, yeah, I know that. But that means I have two wedding dates, and I don't want two wedding dates. I want one.
Were those people correcting you on the legal facts or pointing out legal facts? Were they men?
How did you guess, John? Yes,
There should be a special word for men explaining things.
Do you know what, though? I'm not, like, while mansplaining is a thing.
Oh,
and it
that's
is
good. That's
definitely, good. John, let me mansplain mansplaining to you. While it is definitely a thing, I do think, and while it is mostly men, it is not as clear-cut gender. I think it's a type of person.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think we should just call it splaining, which is when you explain something to someone who already knows, but you feel still that you have to tell them.
Yes.
You can tell the tweets are signified because they always start with something like,
actually,
I think you'll find, or, but surely, or, why don't you?
Where does a man get his water from? From a well, actually.
Yay! Lovely. Like it.
We haven't just come on this podcast to chat about Angela's wedding. This is a history of marriage and weddings down the millennia.
It is. I mean, particularly, we're focusing it in Britain because obviously marriage laws are different everywhere.
Yes.
And it's about sort of the laws of marriage rather than anything else, sort of how its marriage has changed over time.
And those laws probably reflecting sort of the status of marriage and the culture from which they spring.
Telling
us all about that. So I'm intrigued. You're leading on this one, Angela. You've researched it because you're obsessed with marriage and weddings.
So obsessed with marriage. Yeah, yeah. It's all I can think about.
I think Matt's going through with it, do you?
Well, I hope so, because we posted the invitations today. So he's going to have a lot of explaining to do if it doesn't.
He's training as a runner, isn't he? To run very fast in one direction.
Do you know, he is a runner. My fella's an ultra marathon runner. And lovely Jeremy Hardy, when we did News Quiz, every time I see him, he'd ask how Matt was and say, oh, was he doing any crazy marathons, you know? And one day he just looked at me and he just went, he's running from something, Barnsley, and my money's on it being you. Cheers, Jeremy.
Lovely.
Yeah.
So, sorry to be a pedant and and one of those people on Twitter is going, but how come? But isn't a civil wedding with just a humanist type reading, is that not recognisable as a humanist wedding?
No, for several reasons. One being there's still a script that you have to use. I think there's like three or four, maybe more choices of script, but it's still very prescribed and you can only do them in registered places.
Right.
So I know where I want my wedding. I know what I want it to include and I know what I don't want it to include, but I think it should still be legally recognised. You know, I don't mind. We are 2 days before our wedding. We're going to the registry office and we're signing the thing and it will all be very quick and it's just the legal bit as far as we're concerned. Right. That's not our wedding ceremony. But what upsets me is legally my anniversary is on a different day to my actual anniversary. Do you see what I mean? That's what I don't like about it.
My son had to do this, marrying he married a lovely American girl. And they had to get the legal bit done as quickly as possible. And then we could organise her parents coming over from America. And we did a thing at the Ritzy in Brixton. And that was great. And then back over there, they had a whole thing with a minister. The parents were very keen to have a religious aspect. So there was a minister over there. So they had three weddings. So when I gave my speech, I went, you know, everything's bigger in America. The ice cream, the cars, the buildings. And with weddings, you get three times the portions, you know.
Lovely.
Yeah, that is a weird thing. They celebrate the actual legal date, I think. I think it's up to you which one you want to choose.
Of course it is. I just don't like that we don't have, and particularly as, you know, if we were in Scotland, our wedding would be legal.
Right. So like Gretna Green. If you ran over the border to Gretna Green.
Exactly. That's what got me sort of on this trail, is just looking at the history of marriage as a concept rather than, you know. And what I could have done here, John, I know, you know, this is my research, so it's slightly longer than yours. What I could have done here was started with, you know, human pairings and how we went from groups to pairs and hominids evolved. But I haven't done that, John.
There'll be many listeners disappointed.
I've only gone back to the 5th century.
Okay.
So relatively recent.
Okay, really. That's in Angela's book, notes. That is yesterday. So take me back to the 5th century AD, Angela. And how did people get married then?
So 5th century AD was when the idea of a formalised marriage began. And it was, people didn't marry for love in those days. Marriage was a strategic tool. Like sometime in the early sort of Anglo-Saxon period, it was a way to establish peaceful relationships with your neighbours.
Listeners all over the country picturing their neighbour and going, okay, I think that would be a bit...
We don't do that anymore. Well, it was a way of surviving, really, because obviously it was tribal pretty much in that time. And so if your neighbouring tribe, rather than war with them, if you could marry your daughter to their son,
it makes an alliance
and it's a way of pacifying your neighbor rather than fighting with them.
A bit tough on the kids though to be a pawn in the neighborly negotiations all the time.
But that's just how it was. I mean, we think of arranged marriage as being a thing that they do in other countries, but all marriage was arranged to begin with. You know, that's what marriage was. It was an arrangement of families and strategic alliances. It wasn't to do with love. And, you know, who you loved and who you married weren't necessarily the same person.
Right.
Who married who was decided not by you. It was decided by tribal leaders, by your parents, you would be matched up to people according to your childbearing potential or where these alliances needed to be built, which neighbour you needed to have peaceful resolution with and stuff. So it was very much, that's what marriage was.
And that would have been in pre-Christian Britain.
Pre-Christian times, yeah. Right.
Sorry to go back even further, but I mean, the Romans had wives. So, I mean, you're just talking about in English society, I suppose.
Yeah, that's why I've focused it on this. Because, I mean, we could go back to the ancient world and their sort of... But I thought we'd focus it on Britain. Otherwise, this will be a six-hour-long podcast.
That's quite right. So, we're into Christian Britain now.
597 AD, Pope Gregory I sends a mission from Rome led by Augustine to convert the Anglo-Saxons to Christianity. Now, it was actually quite an easy job because the most powerful man in Anglo-Saxon Britain at that point was Ethelbert, the King of Kent.
Classic Kent person talking. Wessex was harder than we could have had you. You
Kent was where it was at, mate.
Wessex, mate. Maiden name. That's where it was at. Thames Valley. Classic. Oh, we're Kent. We were the most powerful.
I love that we're keeping the Kent and Wessex rivalry alive, John, you and I.
You're a bunch of dukes.
Wondered what you were going to say then.
Yeah, you have to be careful with the pronunciation. Yeah.
So if you want to hear more about Ethelbert, King of Kent, you can listen to our episode on Ethelred the Unready, which was basically a list of me going through all the Anglo-Saxon kings.
You've got a long journey, everyone.
So Ethelbert, King of Kent, was a pagan, but because he wanted to form a peaceful alliance with his neighbours, he married Bertha, who was the daughter of the King of the Franks, and they were Christians.
Okay. That whole mission was based on a naff pun. I don't know if we did this in the previous one, but Gregory was in the marketplace in Rome.
Yeah.
There were some slaves for sale, and he said, "Well, who are those blonde children?" And they said, "Oh, sir, they are Angles." He went, not Angles, but Angels. And everyone went, "Oh, that's very good, very good, very good."
Oh, bravo.
Popeness. No one dared tell him it was a shit pun.
But obviously, my name being Angela.
Of course.
I remember when I was at primary school, and I could never write the word angel without automatically putting an A at the end of it. So my stories were all about how the Angela Gabriel spoke to Mary.
So they're converted to Christianity, you know, regularly.
Yeah, King of the Anglo-Saxons now Christian, and Christianity begins to take hold. And by the 9th century, is the dominant religion. So over the next sort of 400 years,
yes,
it becomes the dominant religion in Britain. Now, it's worth saying that a lot of what you sort of read about the history of marriage is very much about what the important people were doing.
Yes.
Your lower classes, for the first 8 centuries that marriage was a thing,
yeah,
for the important people, the church didn't really give a toss what anyone else was doing.
Yes. I mean, I think this is probably true for those hundreds of years you're talking around, that in rural Britain, I read somewhere that pagan sort of folklore and traditions continued for centuries. It's like saying Brazil is a Christian country. If you go deep into the Amazon jungle, you know, it won't be.
Yeah.
And same with East Anglia. It would have been different to London, you know.
Exactly. So people were still practicing what they'd always practiced their sort of more pagan rituals and stuff. So when we talk about it being a dominant Christian country, it took that long for it to filter through to sort of these communities. They still had marriages and they still made alliances. You'd still want to be on good terms with the small holding next to yours or whatever. And it was still largely parents that paired off.
Right.
It's just that the church didn't really give a shit what you were doing at that point.
I've lost your plough. You know, I borrowed your plough. I've lost it, but you can have my daughter.
But you can have my daughter instead. That's fair swap, I'd say. And of course, at this time, serfdom is still a thing across Europe. So in the Middle Ages, lots of poor people were legally bound to a lord and his lands.
Yes.
And so not only were your parents exercising control over who you married, the lord would as well. You know, so he could prevent his serf from marrying a woman from another manor if it didn't suit his. And they even had the right to choose husbands for their tenants' daughters.
And in some cultures, the droit de seigneur, where they had the right to sleep with the virgin the night before her wedding day.
Actually, that's apparently a myth.
I think it's very rare, is what I read. I think it was very rare. It's in Braveheart and it's in Marriage of Figaro, but I don't think
there
it was
seems
widespread.
To be very little evidence of it actually happening, according to the book that I read.
Okay.
John. By the way, the book that I read for this is called Marriage: A History by Stephanie Kuntz. The book is very much about the global history of marriage, so I use that, but it's very interesting.
So, is there a danger with people marrying their neighbours? They're going to marry their cousins and marry their brothers.
Well,
and sisters?
Yeah, this is really interesting, actually. So, where we are now in the 21st century, you can marry your first cousin should you want to. Lots of people do, particularly in certain, I mean, I'm not going to mention Norfolk particularly, but I'm actually about to marry a man from Norfolk and I'm not his cousin.
He's not his cousin.
So, you know, it's...
You're marrying your sister. It's good enough for your mother and I.
John, we're better than this. We're better than Norfolk.
I got complaints when I put one of those jokes in my books. Somebody was saying Norfolk had more influx of immigrants from the Vikings and the Saxons. And they're going,
it's true.
It is true. Yeah. Sorry, Norfolk. Yeah. Sorry, Norfolk. Tell me more about incestuous marriages. This isn't an interest of mine, by the way.
Yeah, I said, why do you want to know more about this? The opportunity for marriage obviously isn't like it is today, where basically, you know, we travel places.
No Tinder.
There's no Tinder, John. No. And there was no, you know, you wouldn't necessarily meet people from anywhere more than 5 miles away from where you lived, you know.
Yeah.
So it was very likely that quite a lot of incestuous marriages happened. However, the rules changed regularly through the centuries to the point where it's really unclear when the changes happened as to what constituted an incestuous marriage, because the people in charge would use rules on incestuous marriage as ways to get out of marriage. Divorce wasn't a thing.
No.
At this point, marriage was supposed to be for life. But if you found out that, oh no, you're actually my seventh cousin first removed, right. I now have to divorce you. So whereas we imagine that they're all marrying their cousins in the Middle Ages and they're all, actually they weren't. And it was a remarkable amount of distance you had to have at certain times in the Middle Ages in order to marry, because people would use that as an excuse to...
Right. That's interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. In Iceland, you can get your DNA test now, and you can sort of, there's an app where you can start dating someone, because it's such a small pool of people.
You can
just look on your phone. No, we're not cousins. Let's go to bed, you know.
But there was a time at some point in the Middle Ages when they ruled that marrying relatives of your godchildren was incestuous.
Okay.
And, you know, so the rules fluxed all the time, but actually the it was much more distant than it is today. But currently, as they stand, John, if you want to marry your first cousin, I mean, you probably have to have a word with Jackie first.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to marry your first cousin, technically you could.
I'm good, thanks.
I've got 41 of the buggers to choose from.
Have you really? Got three or something.
Yeah, I've got loads of them. So we now are in the 12th century.
Okay.
Okay, we've skipped forward a bit. 600 years of marriage being a thing in Britain.
Yeah.
But it's not until the 12th century, really. There's this first step towards it being not just a sort of power or economic arrangement. It's a first step towards it being about the couple rather than just their families and
I see
what it means. So there was a Benedictine monk called, I think, Gratian? Who knows? Anyway, I mean, lots of people know, but we don't.
No.
But he decided that the consent of the couple mattered more than their family's consent.
Okay.
The consent of the couple had never been taken into account till this
point. Quite forward-looking of the of Gratian.
Yeah, absolutely. For a sort of Catholic doctrine writer,
yeah.
He brought the idea of consent into the fold of this formalised marriage arrangement in 1140. He wrote a canon law textbook. Canon law is church law, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, everything at this point is canon law,
yes,
pretty much.
Of course.
Everything's governed by that. So he writes a canon law textbook, the Decretum Gratiani.
Oh.
And this is the first time where couples are required to give their verbal consent.
Wow.
And to consummate the marriage in order to forge a marital bond.
I have to say, Angela, reading through your notes, the consummation of the marriage seems to play too big a part in the interests that the clergy have in weddings. They're always like, yeah, did they consume the marriage though? Did they have sexual intercourse in the marital bed?
I don't know if it was all just dirty monks wanting to know. I think that the main reasons for consummation being a thing were... And this feels to us now what we know about power and sex and things.
Yeah.
This feels weird, but consummation was seen as a way of the couple giving consent.
Okay.
By consummating the marriage, they were consenting to it. Because before that, the bride and groom just being present at the ceremony was enough.
Right.
But they had no choice in that, really. Obviously, we know now that sometimes people have no choice in consummation either, but that's a whole different subject.
I mean, you get these sort of films set in sort of Russian countryside in the 19th century where they sort of roll out the bedsheet to show that blood was spilled on the wedding night.
Yeah,
cheer and so. Bit embarrassing, I'd say, if you're the bride.
Embarrassing. And also not foolproof that, you know, so
no.
Not all women bleed. So there were lots of women who were chastised for not being virgins who were virgins. They just didn't, you know,
didn't
bleed. So it's all.
I'm not sure it's a very satisfactory system, if I'm honest.
No. And also the technical definition of consummation is an act which could result in procreation, right?
Okay.
So it has to be full penetrative works and it has to be without contraception for it to be technical.
Okay.
So even today, a heterosexual marriage can still be annulled on the grounds of non-consummation, but a homosexual marriage can't be...
Right, of course.
Annulled on it because obviously in a homosexual procreation's not a possibility.
No,
so
well,
interesting.
Yeah.
So this book sort of formed the foundation for the church's marriage policies at this time, and it spoke about clerical marriage, which obviously not allowed under the Catholic doctrine.
Big mistake. Big mistake. If you want to, you don't want your priests turning up a bit weird, just let them get married, guys. Just like, yeah. this is going to come back and bite you later on. Not letting the priests marry.
I haven't really included this in the notes, so I won't go on about too much. But in that book that I was talking about, there's a really interesting section about how celibacy was seen as a sort of way to, because women were devil women who trying to tempt men.
Yeah,
you know, it was always the women that had the agency. And so it was always a woman's fault, obviously, if a priest was tempted out of celibacy. It was that damn harlot's fault every time, you know.
So could anyone get married? Was it like, were there age limits?
The only rules at this point for governing marriage are that the couple have to publicly declare their intent to be husband and wife.
Right.
And they have to be 14 if you're a boy, 12 if you're a girl.
Well, that's a disaster.
Which is a disaster.
What 14-year-old boy can publicly even talk to a girl? It's like, it's
different
he's
times,
embarrassed.
John. I think the things to remember are, one, you know, at this time in the Middle Ages, 14 makes you middle-aged.
Well, no, the way Pretty it would much. Have been done in those days, it would have been their mates saying, Degsy loves you. Shut up. Degsy loves you. Will you go out with my mate?
And I think the other thing to remember is as well that betrothals would happen with children, but they weren't necessarily consummated until much later.
I hope not.
It does make us recoil when we go, oh, girls are getting married at 12, but it's like they were betrothed at 12, were they, you know.
Well, okay.
It's a different, and actually people were betrothed. There's a story I read about like a two-year-old being betrothed.
Yes, I think it's happening in royalty as well.
And because you had to publicly declare your own intent to get married, she would be like prompted by her mum, like, now say yes, I give consent. And the little two-year-old, yes, I give consent.
I'm sure there's I'm sure there's some little children's shows in the southern states of America where they dress them up and make them do this.
Very possibly.
Little Miss Sunshine type pageants. So where are we now? We're still in the 12th century?
So at this point, you're married. If you didn't have to, there were ceremonies, pagan ceremonies and stuff, but you didn't have to have a ceremony to be married. All you had to do is say, we're married, or we want to be married.
Cheaper.
And then you
were
married. Right. Yeah, much cheaper. Tell me about it. No bridal shower.
No, you know, planning dinner. Or
none of that.
Like that.
None of that. There were different customs. One of them involved a couple jumping over a broomstick, which is where the phrase jump the broomstick comes from for sort of quick marriages. But until the 12th century, that's all you needed for a marriage to be valid. And then step forward, Peter Lombard, Bishop of Paris. Because consummation confirmed marriage, right? You were betrothed and then at consummation you were married, right?
So the Bishop of Paris goes, I'm the Bishop of the City of Love.
Well, he pointed out if consummation is the point at which you're married, that means Mary and Joseph weren't married.
Right. Well, wasn't the father of Mary's baby God?
Well, allegedly, yes.
Okay.
but, yeah. So was she then married to God?
I don't know.
It's all very confusing, isn't it?
It doesn't stand up to a great deal of scrutiny, if we're honest, Angela.
It doesn't. But what Lombard then said was, right, okay, this idea of it only being consummated at the point of procreation is nonsense. As long as you make a promise in the present tense, I take you as my husband, I take you as my wife, that legally makes a wedding.
Okay.
So that's where that came from. Now, this put the church in a slightly awkward position.
Right.
Because they had to go along with what the Bishop of Paris had said. But what this meant was that young couples that wanted to get married without their parents' approval could just say, I take you, ha, we're married, deal with
it. It's like the modern equivalent of the compass tattoo in the arm.
Exactly.
In double maths.
Exactly. Done it now, what are you going to do? So the Fourth Lateran Council, John.
I've read a lot about that.
They decreed at this council that for a marriage to be valid, three things were necessary. One, the bride had to have a dowry. Two, the banns had to be published beforehand. And three, the wedding had to take place in a church.
Okay, we're getting quite modern then, really.
So now we're getting to the point of really formalising that ceremony.
Yeah, and a service that we would recognise today.
And for a church wedding today, you still have to have your banns read. The word banns, it means proclamation. So the banns are a public announcement of a forthcoming marriage, which would be made in the parish church for three Sundays in a row prior to the wedding, and it gave a chance for any objections to be made to the wedding.
So I remember when Gordon Brown was marrying Sarah, I think they wanted it done in secret, but they read the banns in the church and it was like John Gordon Brown, and I think just like three old pensioners there, it didn't get out. It was like No journalist was hanging around in there, you know.
No.
And eventually somebody told somebody, but I think they got away with it for a week or two.
Wow. At this point, parents still obviously made these decisions disregarding their children's wishes. You know, although people were starting to get married from their own consent, yeah, you were very much owned by your parents. And there was a story of in 1413, there were two fathers from Derbyshire and they signed a marriage contract for their children, but they left the bride's name blank because he hadn't decided which daughter he was going to marry off yet. Oh, he's like, I'll decide on the day. I'll decide on the day which one's pissing me off most. Which one goes?
Ib dib, sky blue, who's it, not you.
It's bad, isn't it?
It wouldn't make much of a Jane Austen novel, would it, really?
It's funny. Well, we'll come on to when things really changed in a bit.
So at this point, I'm presuming lots of children were born out of wedlock. How did that fit into all of this?
So while, you know, the peasants, if you like, mm-hmm, were still scrutinising who should marry whom and building these alliances a bit, the order in which childbirth and marriage happened didn't really matter.
I like the way you said who married whom there, Angela.
Oh, yes.
At the beginning of the podcast, it was who, if you don't mind saying, it was who married who. But you've come on a bit since this podcast has developed and the grammar has improved.
Did I say who married who earlier?
At the beginning you did, yeah. But now it's whom, and I'm pleased to see, you know,
I'm
as
learning,
you get closer
John,
to your wedding day, you're becoming more and more suitable. So they were cavalier.
Yeah, well, it just wasn't particularly of a concern to a peasant community if a child was born out of wedlock.
No.
There was a letter written by the Bishop of Lincoln in the 13th century. In this letter, it noted that the traditional custom during a wedding, if the couple already had a child born before the ceremony, they would stretch what they called a care cloth over the child as the couple knelt in front of the altar, and that would legitimise the child somehow.
Of course, that does it. That'll do it. That's
so
weird, isn't it?
According to common law, however, like the state law, the subsequent marriage of a couple didn't legitimise their child. But peasants just ignored that. Didn't really,
there must have been a lot of it about.
Who
I'm
cared?
Guessing.
Yeah, exactly. No contraception at this time. So
there was some contraception, I think, that they used sort of hankies and things like that. In Othello, isn't the hanky found in Desdemona's boudoir evidence?
But you that, and I both know, John, that a hanky is very absorbent. They hadn't invented crisp packets at that point. But at this time, a woman who didn't marry the father of her child wasn't necessarily considered damaged goods in these peasant communities. You know, it wasn't, she wasn't outcast, she wasn't. And there's some records that I saw from Halzoan Manor, which I think is in the Midlands, isn't it?
Yeah.
Between 1270 and 1348, that estimates that for every two women who gave birth in marriage, one woman gave birth out of wedlock.
Wow. Same in the Midlands now, are they?
Well, probably the other way around. But many of these women still went on to marry quite well, which shows that there wasn't really a stigma attached to, otherwise they wouldn't have been able to subsequently marry. So now we sort of come to the early modern period, 16th century. Marriage in Britain starts to undergo quite a lot of changes. So obviously we know about Henry VIII.
Yeah, he got married a few times.
He got married once or twice. Yeah. Obviously the big thing about Henry VIII was his divorce from Catherine of Aragon in order to marry Anne Boleyn. He had two divorces, didn't he? One for adultery, one for treason in the end.
He was divorced, beheaded,
died, divorced, beheaded, survived.
And you remember what Mark Steele's joke about the modern royal family?
No.
Divorce, crashed.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that must be a massive deal then. Henry VIII must be sort of changing the divorce laws or making divorce sort of.
Well, yes and no. I mean, what changed more than divorce remained, and we'll come on to divorce in a bit, but it remains pretty much not a thing for quite some time afterwards. What it changed, obviously, was the whole structure of religion in Britain. So up until, because Henry had been a defender of the Catholic faith against the teachings of Martin Luther, you know, and he only really changed his mind about that when it suited him, a bit like Boris Johnson of his day.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So the former Archbishop of Canterbury was Thomas Cranmer, who granted the divorce after the English Reformation. So because Henry wanted a divorce, the Catholic faith wouldn't allow it, so they turned to the Protestants, who would.
Yes.
And then in 1549, Thomas Cranmer scripts the first wedding vows for the Church of England in his Book of Common Prayer.
Great read. If you're going to buy in a bookshop, people, don't buy on Amazon. If you're buying the 1549 Book of Common Prayer, let Cranmer get some money for this. It's not fair.
So in 49, you've got the Act of Uniformity, which makes, essentially, we're now a Protestant country. and the Book of Common Prayer contain the first wedding vows written entirely in English. And it's pretty much the same as what we know today, John. Got all the greatest hits are there. To Have and to hold. Yeah. From This Day Forward, Better for Worse, Richer for Poorer, all of that.
To Love,
there.
Honour and Obey. You're going to obey Matt.
Of
and your
course I am, John. Yes, of course. Could you imagine?
I cannot imagine anything else. I remember it being a bit of a scandal when Princess Di, or Lady Diana Spencer, she was then, was not going to have obey in her wedding vows. It was like all over the front pages.
Yeah.
He's going to be king, to be fair, but never mind. I don't think that's what did for the marriage.
I don't think it is. And to be fair, if he was going to be king anyway, well, we're all supposed to obey him, aren't we?
That's so, true.
You know,
that's
true. Tautology.
Yeah. So maybe she thought it was a tautology.
Yeah,
that's
exactly. So it was basically all stolen from the Catholic medieval rites of marriage anyway. But right. That was in Latin. So, you know. And at this point now, the clergy are also permitted to marry. So if you're a Church of England clergyman, you are now allowed to marry.
So if it's all in Latin, the answers were in the back in English, I presume, in the last page. If you flick to the back page, that's a joke that only works for people my age who studied Latin.
Right, okay. So your age and class, John, let's be honest.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
So the Catholic Church, as a sort of act of counter-reformation against this, in the Council of Trent, John, so you remember we had the...
Council of Trent, yeah.
Yeah, this is the Council of Trent, which is not like Nottinghamshire. This is Trento in Italy.
Trent Council. Lab now largest party. Remains in no overall control.
This is the 19th Ecumenical
Council of Trent.
Council of Trent, yes. Prompted by the Protestant Reformation.
Don't say I never take you out. Don't say I never give you a good time. We're going to the Ecumenical Council of Trent. Oh, thank you, darling.
So this is, I mean, since the 12th century, the Roman Catholics referred to marriage as a sacrament, but it wasn't until 1563 at the Council of Trent where it was officially made the marriage ceremony a sacred ceremony, a sacrament in its own right.
That's wonderful.
And for the first time, the validity of marriage in the Catholic faith was made dependent upon the wedding taking place before a priest and two witnesses.
That's like, again, like now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And this is where parental consent was no longer deemed completely necessary.
Wow,
so there we go.
Yeah.
So I think we'll take a little break here. I'm just going to go and ring my mum and check she's remembered to put my dowry aside.
Some Green Shield stamps and some Lidl vouchers. Welcome back to We Are History. We're talking about marriage in the year that Angela plans her own wedding. I had to... raise a toast to my son, Freddie, and his wife, Bethany, at their wedding recently. And I raised their glass, said, to Freddie and Lily. That's his sister.
Oh, no. Did you say then, that? Did you say to Freddie
and
Lily?
I did.
Oh, my God.
And then I was telling this story. I told that story at the American wedding in front of hundreds of guests. And at the end, I went, anyway, let's raise our glasses to Freddie and Lily. I did it again.
But don't worry, John, because that time they just thought it was a callback.
Yeah, they thought it was a callback.
Like, he's
great.
Very funny,
it's quite convincing.
Isn't he? Very funny.
It was very convincing the way he did it. It seemed like it was a genuine mistake. And my son knew it wasn't.
It's funny. We're talking about speeches, and I think Matt's best man's a bit nervous because obviously at my wedding there's going to be a lot of comedians and comedy writers. Now, you and I know that we're the best audience because we'll be willing them to do what, you know, we're not going to sit.
No. My wedding, I was all bloody comedians and comedy writers, and every joke I did. You know, all the best man did. They're all stroking their chins going, yeah, that works. That's a good go. Yeah.
What a nightmare.
Anyway, tell us where we are now.
So we're in the 17th century now. Yes. Child marriage was a particular issue in the 17th century. There's quite a lot's been written about that, about these sort of young betrothals and things. But it's just
weird.
Different times. There was a brief time during, this is quite interesting, during Cromwell's Protectorate in the 1650s, where they raised the marriageable age to 14 and 16.
God,
so,
radical.
Yeah, much nearer to where we are today. However, that was just during that. And if you want to hear about Cromwell's Protectorate, I know a good podcast about it, John.
Oh, we know a podcast about
We do
about
know
that.
A podcast about So I do
slightly worry that when Charles II came back and it was like, yeah, let's open the theatres. Yeah, let's have Christmas back. Yeah, let's marry 12-year-olds.
Whoa.
No, you got too far there, mate.
Yeah. So really, the marriage is just continuing the same way.
Hundreds of years.
Until the next sort of legislation on marriage isn't until 1753. And what happens?
Would that be Lord Hardwick's marriage, Jack?
It would be.
I'm just racking my memory of reading your notes.
It would indeed be Lord Hardwick's marriage, Jack. Now, this was the first state involvement in marriage. Up to this point, it had all been canon law, it had all been church law. And this is the first time the state is starting to get involved in marriages. And the reason they do that is because there's a lot of what they call clandestine marriages are happening, which is where, you know, young people running away to get married, doing it without parental consent. Because up to this point, you didn't have to get married in a church particularly.
Did you not get married in front of a priest? I thought we just said you had to get married in front of a priest.
Yeah, but it didn't have to be in a church.
Oh, right. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. I'm being a pedant.
Yes, you are, John.
So this is the state increasing its control. Yeah. Isn't it? They're saying, we can't just leave this to the vicars. This is the politicians getting involved.
Have you heard of Fleet marriages, John? They're quite interesting.
No.
So Fleet marriages, you have Fleet Prison, which was the famous debtors' prison in London. Due to some bylaw, I think, you could get married in Fleet Prison and its surrounds. So people would go, in the way they go to Gretna Green, now they would go to Fleet Prison to get married.
Oh, we're going to get married. Where have you booked, darling? Yeah. That lovely little cliff by the with the trees and the river underneath. No, we're getting married at the prison.
Exactly. So to put a stop to that, Lord Hardwick's Marriage Act comes into force in 1753. And this stated that each parish had to keep a record of all the marriages registered there. So it's sort of the beginning of a more robust registry.
Registration of births, marriages and deaths. It's the beginning of that, isn't it? Moving towards that.
Yeah, exactly. And it also meant that there were more stringent conditions for the validity of a marriage. So from this point onwards, only marriages conducted by the Church of England or by Quakers or under Jewish law were recognised in England and Wales. So,
wow. So if you're Catholic and you got married by a priest, it wasn't recognised?
No, you had to get married in a Church of England.
What about humanists, Andrew? Were they recognised? Were they recognised at this point?
I don't think at this point they were particularly recognised. Okay. The thing is, John, also, any other form of marriage was abolished at this point. So children who were born into unions that weren't valid under the Act couldn't inherit the property of their parents, for example. They were illegitimate. Wow. The only exceptions were Quakers and Jewish people who could get married in their own places of worship. This is the first time that a legal age limit is being set for marriage.
Okay, as opposed to a canon one.
The Hardwick Act set full age at 21, which means without parental consent. But the minimum age for marriage with consent stayed at 12 and 14. Do you know when that law changed, John, the 12 and 14?
Probably in southern states in the United States, probably not yet.
No, but in England.
Or the 19th century?
1929.
God, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's ridiculous. So you could get your parents could marry off at 12
yep.
in 1929. Yep. That is amazing.
And in 1929, it moved to 16 for both sexes, but still 21 full age without parental consent. Whereas today, you can get married at 16, but with parental consent, and 18 without.
Okay.
And it stays that way until...
Marriage Act. And I'm trying to think when the Marriage Act, the next Marriage Act was. Was it 1836, the next Marriage Act?
It's almost like, John, you can see my notes.
No, I'm just very good at history. I've done the work. I've read the books. So the Marriage Act of 1836.
Yeah. Now, this is exciting, John. Why is this exciting?
This was the... you're allowed to get married at Alton Towers on Thunder Mountain.
Not quite, John.
Okay.
Did you get married in a registry office?
I got married in King's Road registry office.
Oh,
I got married in 1990. Mm-hmm. You still could only get married in a church or a town hall. Mm. And for me, Wandsworth Town Hall was, Tories had just won a landslide. I'd lost an election there. I didn't want to get married in the borough where I live.
I just lost an election there. I don't want to get married there. Yeah.
So I lied. We lied about living at my parents' flat in Notting Hill. So that was the borough of Kensington, Chelsea. And they went, that's one of our roads. And we got married in the King's Road on the Saturday before Christmas.
I just want to say as well, like John sometimes tries to convince me he's not as posh as I think he is. But now he's just told me that his parents just had a flat in Notting Hill. Whatever, that's normal.
We're posh. So...
Sorry, John.
My mum was posh. My dad was. I think it was Edwina Curry who changed the laws that you could get married at football grounds and nice...
Yeah, it's relatively recent. I remember that law coming in, yeah. They still had to be licensed, but they didn't have to be a civil building necessarily.
You could do it at the Trafalgar Pub at Greenwich. Lovely.
Yeah. Well, my friend got married there. It's very nice.
Yeah,
on the river.
Friend got married there too.
Lovely.
Yeah. Do continue with... you were talking about the Marriage Act for 1836, I understand.
It was referred to as the Broomstick Marriage Act in a sort of contemptuous way because it was seen by religious people as a way to to sort of legitimise a sham marriage.
Oh, I see. So did that mean that Catholics could get married and stuff like that at this
point? It meant non-conformist Catholic couples could get married in their own places of worship with their own rites.
Yeah.
You could get married in non-religious buildings, although there was still a religious aspect, I think a Church of England aspect to the ceremony. It didn't have to be in a church. So, yeah, this was a really big change.
Yeah, that's a big change. Yeah, that's sort of very liberating for people. Just after the Catholic emancipation, of course.
Yeah.
So I suppose things were changing a bit around that point.
Exactly. And this
1829. See, I do know history.
Yeah. 1829. John, you are, may I say, very good at history.
I'm very good at history. I got a B in my history O-level.
I got a B in my history GCSE. No, I got an A.
Ha! Well, you're
better than me, John.
You're better. Well, GCSE. What's that?
Did you do history A-level?
I did, actually. I got a B in that as well.
I didn't do history A-level.
You started one, didn't you? But it was just...
Yeah, I ran out of time. Yeah, but I started one in my 30s for fun and then never finished it.
And you thought, I'll do a history podcast instead.
Pretty much, yeah, because then I get to choose the topics that I study instead.
So most of the time in British history, weddings have been overseen by the Church of England.
Yeah.
Even if you were like Catholic, if you wanted to be married, you would have had to do it in the Church of England.
Absolutely. Is that right? That's right. God. Yeah, yeah, yeah. This was also the time that the state first started keeping statistics, national statistics for marriage. What I find interesting about the Victorians, John, is... This is the point when really marrying for love, as we sort of know it today, becomes the thing to do. You have Victoria and Albert, although, you know, royal marriages tend to be quite strategic, they were very vocal about it being a love match.
Well, I think what would Victoria help this, if someone would do some sort of TV or film adaptation of a Jane Austen novel... We might get then some sense of what it was like. But
just
cannot get one for love, not money. So Jane Austen's just a bit before that, isn't she? But she's sort of Georgian. Victorians are all like love and romance. So Queen Victoria, I understand, was the one who popularised the white wedding dress.
Yes, apparently so.
She had one and now it symbolises virginity.
And, what are you talking about, John? I'm wearing white at my wedding. What are you saying?
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, I can't tell you anymore because Matt listens to the podcast. So.
Not a little Bo Peep outfit. With
it's got very puffy sleeves. I've gone full meringue, John. You'll be pleased to know.
So we've got the Victorians with their bigger families.
Yeah.
Birth control out around this time.
Well, this is when the whole sort of marriage and procreation doctrine starts to change a little bit because Catholic and Anglican doctrine both put procreation as the primary reason to get married.
Yep.
But in the late 19th century, there's this sort of feelings change because more children are surviving. So throughout the Middle Ages, up to this point, really in the early modern period, children's survival rates weren't
so low.
You know.
That was your contraception.
Well,
yeah, I'm pregnant, but he's going to die. So.
Yes, so as public health improved, more children are surviving and suddenly families have these massive amounts of children.
Yeah.
And so couples start using rudimentary birth control more to limit the number of pregnancies. And you've got the process of sort of decoupling procreation from marriage at some level starts to, to happen.
Did the Anglican Church accept contraception at this point or did that come later?
No, that came not till the 30s did
1930s.
Yeah, that's when artificial contraception was sort of cautiously accepted by the Anglican Church.
So they must have had a little conference and they talked about that. Must have been like embarrassing for them to all sit around and talk about this.
Absolutely.
Talk about rubber johnnies.
Absolutely. And of course, for the Catholic Church, procreation today still remains the essential thing that marriage is about. And technically, I mean, I don't know how much this is actually practiced, but if a couple said they weren't going to have children, technically the Catholic Church shouldn't be marrying them.
Wow, that's amazing. I remember when I was a kid, just not quite recently in Ireland, you couldn't get condoms. You know, it's just, people would go up to the north and buy a load and come down with them.
Yeah.
Where are we up to now?
The sort of most recent marriage act, the basis of the current marriage legislation, even though it's been amended several times since, it was the Marriage Act of 1949 that came in 1950.
1949 was the year my parents got married.
Oh, there you go. Marriage for people under 16 was abolished entirely at this point. So, although I think there were dispensations from the 1929 Act, but that was the main change from 1949. The next big change obviously came in 2005, John.
Yes, well, this would be under the new Labour government when civil partnerships were introduced.
Absolutely.
And, I don't think that government gets enough credit for just how forward-looking it was on gay rights. There were no votes in it at the time. It's the controversial and sort of scandalised the Daily Mail and the House of Lords. Age of consent was made the same for gay people as for straight people. Gays were allowed in the army and civil partnerships.
Yeah.
Civil partnerships was like an incremental thing towards marriage that they brought in just to make sure it passed.
Absolutely.
The Lords.
I think, you know, it's a shame because Iraq sort of overshadowed everything.
Yeah, everything else that government has done, but they did.
But yeah. It is where, you know, credit where it's due.
And now, of course, that's been updated so that you can have marriage, gay marriage, and also now you can have a heterosexual civil partnership, which is very recent.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And then in 2013, we had the Marriage Same-Sex Couples Act, which equalises same-sex, sort of up, you could upgrade your civil partnership should you want to a marriage. So it is on an equal footing with heterosexual marriage. That was given royal assent on the 17th of July, 2013. So it preserves the canon law of the Church of England, which states that marriages between opposite sex couples only. The Church of England, Catholic Church, Church of Wales, they all still oppose same-sex marriage. So no religious organisation is obliged to perform them under the Act,
which
there's obviously still a lot of debate, regular debate about, because there are lots of Church of England clergy who are gay, who are out and gay, John. But what about, John, what about when it all goes horribly wrong?
Well, you're getting married this year. You don't need to think about this for at least a couple of years, about divorce.
As a child of parents...
Oh, yes, of course.
...who were both divorced...
You are from a broken home.
I am from a broken home, and both of my parents were divorced twice each.
Well, that's pretty good going. So, I'd say, to be divorced once is misfortune.
Yes, it's careless to be divorced twice. I think I'm very lucky coming from parents in a divorced family, because I think it doesn't set you unrealistic goals of what marriage is and what... I've got friends whose parents are still together and very much in love, and it has screwed their relationships because their expectations are so high. I know you've managed it, John. Lots of people manage it.
COVID has been a bit difficult because my wife tells me that because of the pandemic, I have to live in the cellar for the whole of the year. that's just a thing, apparently.
That's the law, yeah. No, it is,
that's the
John,
law
that's
she tells
right.
me. I mean, yeah. As she chucks the food down the wooden steps.
You only have pizza, don't you, John? She can slide it under the door.
That's right. But, you know, that's a loving marriage apart from that. But yeah, divorce. Tell me about...
Yeah, up till 1858, the church would occasionally grant... You could get judicial separation for three reasons up to this point. Adultery, a partner's heresy, which was spiritual fornication, it was known as. And extreme cruelty. But, you know, also, how do you define extreme...
I'll tell you how we define extreme cruelty. Last night, Jackie said, the old town where we live in Clapham, it's heaving, all the pubs are open, there's loads of pubs open. Should we go down there? I went, all right, then. We went down there, and I said, so where should we get? Should I get a pint? Oh, she went, I just meant to have a look. Have a look at the full pubs on the day the pubs opened
taking
again.
Taking you to look at a pub, John.
Let's look at all
so
these people
cruel.
After months and months of pubs closed down. She goes, let's go down. Yeah, definitely.
This reminds me of, like, when I was a kid, my dad used to drive me to Gatwick to look at all the people going on holiday. Like, oh, no, I wonder where they're going. I don't know. I know where we're going. Dad, we're going to Camber Sands again, aren't we? Thanks.
That's hilarious. Yeah, so anyway, that's grounds for divorce.
Yeah.
I've got it now.
You would have to obviously prove your grounds for divorce. So a man's impotence, for example, was grounds for annulment. But to prove
Let's move on this bit. We don't need to talk about this.
I think it's like men would have to go through this humiliating ordeal to make sure that he and his wife weren't just colluding to end a marriage. So this is how the rules read, right? It said the man and woman are to be placed together in one bed, and wise women are to be summoned around the bed for many nights.
Well, wise women, that's a turn off for some sections. Well, yeah.
I don't think wise women means, you know, that it was Dent coming in.
It doesn't mean Jermaine Greer and Mary Beard.
Susie Dent was the wrong person to choose then, wasn't she? Because she's fit. But anyway.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now? The politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann-Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, they would be summoned around the bed for many nights, and if the man's member is always found useless and as if dead, the couple are able to be separated. Oh, so as long as you could remain flaccid while some women dance around you.
Some wise women were checking your member.
Yeah, you could remain.
If Mary Beard says nothing's happening, that's good enough for them.
So 1617, Parliament passed an act allowing a certain John Manners, who was Lord Roos, to divorce his wife. And that became the precedent for parliamentary divorces on the grounds of the wife's adultery. But that's it up until that point.
But that's for the posh, isn't it?
That's for the posh. And it's only if the wife was being adulterous. Men, do what you like.
Right.
And it wasn't until the 1857 Matrimonial Causes Act, which let ordinary people divorce. Before that point, divorce was largely only open to men, had to be granted by an act of parliament, and was hugely expensive, only open to the rich.
There was a whole business of people faking affairs and all that stuff, wasn't there?
Yeah. But even in 1858, the point was it was still expensive because you'd have to go through a legal process. So it was still only available for the richest people, really. It was too expensive for most people.
So what are the grounds on that one?
The grounds on that one were aggravated adultery. This is the first time women, I think, could initiate divorce, really, on the grounds of aggravated adultery, that their husbands have been guilty of cruelty, desertion, bigamy, incest, sodomy, or bestiality.
Yep. Got the set.
Yeah. Well done. Bingo. And if you listen to our Jack the Ripper podcast, you know, we talk a lot there about men and women, particularly of the lower classes, couldn't afford to divorce. They would just live separately. And that's why women couldn't receive any financial aid, because they were still owned by their husbands. And it was a messy, messy situation, particularly for women who couldn't get out of bad marriages without becoming destitute.
Yeah, I mean, in Ireland, in the sort of, you know, right up until quite recently, if a woman was being beaten up by her husband, she couldn't run away, she couldn't divorce. The way that divorce happened was her brother and dad and cousins would go round, see that bloke and go, "You're moving out, or we're going to break all your ribs." And, you know, they remained married but far apart. And that was the sort of the only way it could be made to work. It was a crazy system. But that was, you know, that was, if you were lucky, a woman lucky enough to have brothers and cousins who could do that for you.
But yeah, you had to make a decision as a woman, you know, what's worse, being destitute, not being able to feed my children, or being in an abusive marriage. In 1937, the law was changed to allow other grounds for divorce, including drunkenness, insanity and desertion. But the gates for divorce really opened with the Divorce Reform Act of 69. And that allowed you just to cite marital breakdown as the reason for a split. So up until this point, there had to be evidence of cruelty or abuse.
Yes. That was a big reform at the time. Mm. It's part of that whole set of reforms brought in by Roy Jenkins as the Home Secretary when he had, you know, we had abortion coming in and legalisation of homosexuality. It was a very progressive social reforming government, that the Labour government of the 1960s.
Yeah.
It was the first time that was accepted as a thing, really. Marriage was for life was part of the script, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
It became less shocking. My mum actually used to, when my sister got divorced, she was always like, "Well, I stayed with your father, so I don't see why she can't." It was always like, "All right, mum, don't slag off dad."
Yeah.
But today, that generation still thought it was something to be endured.
Well, it was that you hadn't worked hard enough somehow.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and that you had, I mean, bullshit, obviously. Why should you be unhappy just because of what reason? But that's how it was. And this is the first time where, you could leave a bad marriage. It still wasn't easy. It was still expensive. And still, you know, there were conditions.
Solicitors and all that,
Divorces still favoured men. Maintenance for a woman, because they were usually the less wealthy spouse, would be calculated on needs, but that would be decided by a man. You know, it was all these still very unfair. There was the Matrimonial Causes Act in 1973, added some other reasons for divorce. So you still had adultery, unreasonable behaviour, which pertains to physical violence, verbal abuse, insults, threats, drunkenness, drug taking, refusing to pay towards shared living expenses, desertion. So if your husband or wife had left you for 2 years, and then separation. So you could have an agreed divorce after 2 years of separation if both parties agreed to it. If the divorce was contested by one party, it could be granted after 5 years of separation.
Wow, it's quite a long time, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. And then the next landmark case really for divorce came White v. White in 1996. And it was a couple who'd run a farming business together. It was worth about £4.5 million. They've been married 33 years, and at first his wife was awarded just £800,000.
Right.
And she
right.
took the case to the Court of Appeal, then the House of Lords in 2000, and was finally awarded £1.5 million. And this was a landmark case because it showed the assets should be split fairly, and it was the first time the contribution of a homemaker. You know, if you were at home because you were raising the family and keeping the household, didn't mean you weren't an equal part in the marriage, you know, and financially.
Can I just ask, has Matt seen you reading this big pile of books on divorce?
That's a really good point. Yeah, your idea. Yeah, fine.
I'll just grab another one here. This is a good point. This is interesting. Oh, this is very interesting. So I've been, as I mentioned before, I've been adapting Mrs. Doubtfire for the stage. And my co-writer said his wife came into his office once to see him reading Divorce for Dummies. Because that starts with a divorce. He's trying to get all the legal points right. What are you reading? Oh, it's just a book on divorce. Okay.
Anything you want to tell me, dear?
Yeah.
Anything you want to say? Oh,
well, I hope, Angela, that all these facts of divorce will be of no use to you going forward.
Thank you.
As I think, I feel like with Matt, I have not, I think with Angela and Matt, I've not lost a daughter, but gained a son.
Thank you, John. Well, as you know, my dad's no longer with us. So if you want to come and do the Father of the Bride speech, John, feel free.
I'll come and give you away. Give you away as property to Matt.
Do you know who I'm walking up the aisle with?
Your dog.
My mum and my dog.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
When I got married, even though it's years ago, I didn't have that whole sort of, that whole thing of giving away and that. Mm. I didn't have a stag night. I had a hen night. I had a night out with all my favourite women. It was fantastic.
Well, you see,
all my female friends.
I'm having a hen trip. So my best girlfriends, we're going to a nuclear bunker for my hen do.
That's so bad.
We're staying in a nuclear bunker overnight for...
Well, what if there's a nuclear war breaks out that night? Your hen nut would be the only surviving human.
I've got like a little WhatsApp group of those of us going on that trip, and we've just been booking all the trains and stuff for it. And my friend Beck, she texted, "I can't wait for this. It's going to be a blast." And I was like, "Well, if it is, we're in the right place."
So there might be a scenario in which the future of mankind is just a hen night emerging, and a new religion will grow up with pink balloons and Angela's hens on t-shirts.
Do you know what's really funny about it? Because my friend Gavin is the manager of this bunker, which is why we're having it for the hen do. But he's going to be there because obviously he's got to let us in and everything. So if it does happen, we're down there. It'll be us and Gavin.
Oh, God, he's going to repopulate the world.
Repopulate the earth. Problem is, most of us are in our 40s, so...
If I know Gavin. Thank you for taking us through the history of a marriage, Angela. If you're going to do that as your wedding speech, you might want to cut it down a bit.
Hey, John. One thing I do want to say before we finish is the thing I mentioned at the beginning about humanist weddings not being legal. There are campaigns to try and change that. And I will tweet out on the day this comes out a link where you can sign a petition and write to your MP if you would like to support humanist weddings becoming recognised in England.
You heard it here first, everyone. Sign this petition. Support Angela Barnes in her campaign for humanist weddings. Maybe it will be sorted by September when Angela's getting there. Thank you for listening, everyone, to another great episode.
Go on, John, remember what it's called. Go on. What's the podcast called?
I was going to say, a great episode hosted by, it's called We Are History or some shit. We'll be back next week with another thrilling episode.
Don't forget to give us your lovely 5-star reviews on iTunes. Yeah. They really help get us up the old rating. So you'll
it's
be
so
doing
degrading
us a solid.
Asking for,
it
so
is, but we're not beyond
week.
It though, are we, John?
Please send a pound. Thanks for listening, everyone. Catch you next time.
See ya.